Thank you for listening to this podcast from KX93.5, Laguna's only FM. We invite you to listen to more music and talk on our grassroots nonprofit radio station in Laguna Beach, California, from anywhere in the world on KX93.5.com/listen or on our smartphone apps. But right now, here's that podcast from KX93.5.
KXRN LP Laguna Niguel, Laguna Beach. Member supported KX93.5. This disclaimer is a statement notifying the listening audience that any opinion expressed on the air is not reflective of KX93.5, its management, or its board of directors.
And good morning, Laguna Beach, and all who are listening. Welcome to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage, and I'm a clinical psychologist. And today I have a very exciting topic. It is about the idea of how we combine foods and nutrition to affect our mood. Now, I know initially it's not one of those love and sex topics, so wah wah, but I promise you it's really fascinating. I first became interested in this idea several years ago and tried to seek out information. And I found a few books, actually only two, that really talked about our mood and food and how those are related. And I really want to dive deeper into this topic, not only for my profession, but personally. I am not some massive food guru. I love my sweets. I'm not going to lie. The idea of cutting out all sugars and those things, I would love to say that I could do that, but I probably can't. But I do like this idea. And so I've come across a few interesting TED Talks regarding food and mood, and I'm going to be diving deeper into this topic through my practice. There's actually a way to become certified in learning about how to use micronutrients and things like that to help supplement and regulate our bodies, not necessarily in place of, but ideally in place of antipsychotics and antidepressants and things like that. Although I do want to say that I have great and deep respect for those needs for medications. I just think that it's always important to be seeking and learning new ideas. And so in just a minute, I'm going to play a clip for you by a woman named Julia Ruckledge, and she's a clinical psychologist. She has been studying the relationship between nutrition and mood for the past 10 years or so. And so I'm going to play that clip, and we're going to talk a lot about nutrition and mood and some things you can do potentially to naturally supplement your mood. I think all of us know that when we don't eat well, when we eat super junky food, we don't feel as well. But imagine when you're doing that consistently, what that might do to your body and your brain and your mental health. A lot of research is now supporting the link between the gut and the brain. And so I'm going to talk more about that too. So I'm going to play this clip. Hopefully it's going to go well. And then I'll come back. Hope you enjoy.
In 1847, a physician by the name of Semmelweis advised that all physicians wash their hands before touching a pregnant woman in order to prevent childbed fever. His research showed that you could reduce the mortality rates from septicemia from 18% down to 2% simply through washing your hands with chlorinated lime. His medical colleagues refused to accept that they themselves were responsible for spreading infection. Semmelweis was ridiculed by his peers, dismissed, and the criticism and backlash broke him down, and he died in an asylum 2 weeks later from septicemia at the age of 47. What I am going to talk about today may sound as radical as hand-washing sounded to a mid-19th century doctor, and yet it is equally scientific. It is the simple idea that optimizing nutrition is a safe and viable way to avoid, treat, or lessen mental illness. Nutrition matters. Poor nutrition is a significant and modifiable risk factor for the development of mental illness. According to the 2013 New Zealand Health Survey, the rates of psychiatric illnesses in children doubled over the last 5 years. Internationally, there's been a threefold increase in ADHD, a 20-fold increase in autism, and a 40-fold increase in bipolar disorder in children. And this graph here shows there's been a 4-fold increase in the rates of the number of people who are on disability as a direct consequence of an underlying psychiatric illness. The rates of mental illness are on the rise. So how are we dealing with this problem? Currently, our healthcare system operates within a medical model. Now, this means that you would typically be offered psychiatric medications first, followed by psychological therapies and other forms of support. Our reliance on medications as a frontline form of treatment is evident from the increasing rates of prescriptions. For example, in 2012, 500,000 New Zealanders, that's 1/8 of us, had been prescribed an antidepressant. That's 38% higher than 5 years previously. Similarly, the rates of prescriptions for antipsychotics doubled from 2006 to 2011. Given that this medical model is fairly universal across all Western societies, you would rightfully expect that it was working well. And indeed, in some cases, these treatments save lives. And I'm not here to dismiss it altogether. However, if a treatment is truly effective, then shouldn't the rates of disorder and disability as a direct consequence of that illness be decreasing rather than increasing? And that's why we need to consider the role that medications might be playing in some of these outcomes. If we take any class of medication, antipsychotics, anti-anxiety medications, antidepressants, the pattern is the same. In the short term, these treatments are often very effective, but in the long term, they aren't. And in some cases, they're making life worse. If we look at, for example, studies that have been done on ADHD children treated with stimulants or Ritalin, in the short term, they are better and responding than better responders than any other form of treatment. But in the long term, they fare less well than children who were never prescribed these medications. Another study showed that despite our ever-increasing reliance on antidepressants, the recovery rates and relapse rates are no better now than they were 50 years ago prior to the advent of these medications. And children with depression who are treated with antidepressants are 3 times more likely to convert to bipolar disorder than children who were never given these medications. And people who are randomized to stay on their dose of antipsychotic medications are less likely to recover from schizophrenia in the long term than people who had been randomized to a dose reduction or complete elimination of the drug. And I can show you more and more studies, all highlighting this same bleak picture. So, pretty depressing. Is there another way forward? Almost 2 decades ago, my PhD supervisor at the time, Professor Bonnie Kaplan, told me about some families who were treating themselves with nutrients in southern Alberta, Canada. Now, they had bipolar disorder, psychosis, depression. These are serious conditions. And my education in clinical psychology had taught me that nutrition and diet were of trivial significance for mental health and that only drugs or psychotherapy could treat these serious conditions. But she and others were publishing preliminary data in the earlier part of the century showing people getting well and staying well. And so I decided to study the nutrients, and that's what I've done for the last decade. In 2009, I received some funding to run a randomized placebo-controlled trial using minerals and vitamins, also known collectively as micronutrients, for the treatment of ADHD in adults. And this study was published in the British Journal of Psychiatry in April of this year, and here's what we found. Within just an 8-week period, twice as many people responded in the micronutrient group compared to placebo. Twice as many people went into remission in their depression in the micronutrient group. Hyperactivity and impulsivity reduced into the normal non-clinical range. And those who were taking the micronutrients were more likely to report that their ADHD symptoms were less impairing and less interfering than in their work and social relationships than people who were on the placebo. And 1 year later, those people who stayed on the micronutrients maintained their changes or showed further improvement, and those who were who switched or to medications or stopped the micronutrients actually showed a worsening of their symptoms. Now, I need to tell you something here, and that is when I say micronutrients, I'm actually referring to a dose higher than what you'd get out of a vitamin pill purchased in the supermarket. We, in this study, we gave participants up to 15 pills a day with 36 nutrients. So it would be unlikely that if you went and got an over-the-counter supplement, you would unlikely see these positive benefits, both because the dose is lower and the breadth of nutrients is lower. Now, these positive benefits are not confined to a single study. My lab at the University of Canterbury is the Mental Health and Nutrition Research Group, and we've published over 20 papers in medical journals, all documenting the benefits of micronutrients. For example, this study here showed that we could reduce the symptoms of bipolar disorder in children by 50% with a simultaneous reduction in medications. This study here showed that we could reduce rates of probable post-traumatic stress disorder from 65% down to 18% following the Christchurch earthquakes with a one-month intervention of micronutrients with no change in those not taking the nutrients. Even 1 year later, those people who had received the nutrients were doing better than those who didn't. And we've just replicated these findings in collaboration with researchers at the University of Calgary following the floods of June 2013 in Alberta, Canada. To me, the message is clear that a well-nourished body and brain is better able to withstand ongoing stress and recover from illness. Giving micronutrients in appropriate doses can be an effective and inexpensive public health intervention to improve the mental health of a population following an environmental catastrophe. In my 20-year career, I have rarely seen these dramatic responses from conventional treatments. When people get well, they get well across the board, not only in the symptoms that we treated, but also in other areas like improved sleep, stabilization of mood, reduction in anxiety, and the reduction in need for cigarettes, cannabis, and alcohol. My research and those around the world have shown that 60 to 80% of people respond to micronutrients, showing just how powerful this intervention is. And internationally, there have now been 20 randomized placebo-controlled trials. This is the gold standard that we use to make clinical decisions, showing that we can reduce aggression in prisoners, slow cognitive decline in the elderly, treat depression, anxiety, stress, autism, and ADHD. And they might even be more cost-effective than current conventional treatments. This study here documented the treatment of a 10-year-old boy with psychosis. When his six-month inpatient treatment with medications was unsuccessful, he was treated with micronutrients. Not only did the micronutrients completely eliminate his hallucinations and delusions, changes that were maintained 6 years later, but the cost of the treatment was less than 2% than the cost of the unsuccessful inpatient treatment. The cost savings alone make it imperative that our society pay attention to the wider benefits of this approach. And there is more good news. Treating, supplementing before mental illness emerges can actually stop these problems from developing in the first place. This fantastic study looked at 81 adolescents at risk for psychosis and randomized them to receive either omega-3 fatty acids in the form of fish oils, essential nutrients for brain health, or placebo for a 12-week period. 1 year later, 5% of those who received the fish oil had converted to psychosis versus 28% of those on placebo. That represents an 80% reduction in the chances of you getting converting to psychosis simply through giving fish oils. I wonder if I know what some of you are thinking. I wonder if some of you are thinking, hold on, why don't I just eat better? Why don't I just tell everyone to eat better? And indeed, there are some fantastic studies that document the strong relationship between dietary patterns and mental health, although this is we're still in very early days of scientific investigation. We don't know who would benefit from dietary manipulation alone and who may need the additional boost from extra nutrients. But even in the last 5 years, there have been 11 epidemiological studies cross-sectionally and around the and longitudinally in large populations around the world, all showing the same thing. The more you eat a prudent or Mediterranean or unprocessed type of diet, the lower your risk for depression. And the more you eat the Western diet or processed food, the higher your risk for depression. I know of only one study that has not found this association, and not a single study shows that the Western diet is good for our mental health. What is the Western diet? Well, it's one that is heavily processed, high in refined grains, sugary drinks, takeaways, and low in fresh produce. And the healthy diet is one that is fresh, high in fruits and vegetables, high in fish, nuts, healthy fats, and low in processed foods. What your grandmother would recognize as food. There are still many questions remaining about the relationship between mental health and nutrition. What role do genetics play in determining who's going to respond to nutrients and who needs additional nutrients than they can get out of their diet? What role does an infected, inflamed gut play in the absorption of nutrients? It's not we are what we eat, it's what we are what we absorb. And what role do medications play in determining how effective the nutrients are? Combining medications and nutrients is actually complicated, and we need more research and better understanding these interactions. But ultimately, we need to know how long these good benefits last. So with all of this data, this rich data highlighting the power of nutrition, I think we can make some individual and collective changes now. We could reconsider our current treatment approach, prioritize lifestyle factors, healthy eating, exercise, supplements when necessary, psychological treatments, and save medications for when these approaches don't work. If nutrients work, then shouldn't they be covered through our healthcare system? Take universal prevention seriously by optimizing the nutrition of those who are vulnerable. We don't wait for the heart attack to hit in order for us to modify lifestyle behaviors that we know contribute to heart disease. It should be no different with mental health. An easy way to implement universal prevention would be to have midwives tell pregnant women about the importance of nutrition. Nutrient-depleted mothers produce nutrient-depleted children. Nutrient-poor foods during pregnancy increase the chances that your child will have a mental health problem. Learn about the risks of cheap processed foods. As Michael Pollan stated, cheap food is an illusion. There is no such thing as cheap food. The price is paid somewhere, and if it's not paid at the cash register, then it's charged to the environment and to the public purse in the form of subsidies, and it's charged to your health. All children need to learn how to cook. All children need to know that food doesn't have to come in a packet. Schools could reflect on the content of their lunch menus. Children are too frequently rewarded with processed foods for good behavior. We need to reflect on whether or not this pairing intuitively makes sense. Ultimately, we have a responsibility to teach them that every time they put something in their mouths, they make a choice to eat something nourishing or something nutritionally depleted. In the 19th century, physicians were offended when Semmelweis suggested they wash their hands before delivering babies. We are now asking them to consider whether the medications that they prescribe are contributing to the poor long-term outcome for some people with mental illness. But eating well and when appropriate, additional nutrients can improve the mental health of many people. I leave you with one last thought. Randomized, trials in the 1600s showed that putting limes aboard ships headed out for long voyages completely eliminated the 40% mortality from scurvy, but it took 264 years for the British government to mandate that all ships must carry citrus for their sailors. How long will it take our society to pay attention to the research showing that suboptimal nutrition is contributing to the epidemic of mental illness? So this is my idea we're spreading. Nutrition matters. And if we're really ready to get serious about mental health, we need to get serious about the critical role played by nutrition. Thank you.
And welcome back to Moody with Dr. Sage. You were just listening to a YouTube clip by Julia Ruckledge. She is a clinical psychologist who has an interest in researching the relationship between nutrition and mental illness. And it really grew out of her own research or some research that she read showing that there were poor outcomes for children with psychiatric illnesses despite conventional treatments. And so for the past 10 years or so, she's been exploring and researching and investigating the role of micronutrients in mental illness. Now, I do want to say a couple of things regarding that clip. This idea is about exploring options. This is not to say that there is no place for prescriptions for mental illness, specifically for pharmacology with regard to psychiatric illness. This is just to present there are additional options and ways of exploring. I find that what I bring to the show are topics that I'm interested in because I'm in the field, I'm exposed to a lot more. And I sort of sometimes I think I naturally assume that other people know about these things because, frankly, a lot of my friends are also therapists, which is its own interesting dynamic. But I do believe in sharing these, you know, these types of sources of information with you guys. So if you want to watch this clip more, there are some slides she shows during the presentation. It's a TEDx talk, and it's for Julia Ruckledge, R-U-C-K-L-I-D-G-E. Now, also I found the American Psychological Association had published an article regarding the links between food and mental health. And later at the end of the show, I'm going to offer you some additional resources that you can access if you'd like to learn more, both if you are a clinician or therapist, and also if you are just someone who wants to know more about the relationship between food and mood. All right. So let's talk a little bit about what micronutrients are. Micronutrients or micronutrient deficiencies are really the idea that there is not enough of one or more micronutrients needed for our optimal health. And so in humans and other animals, they include both vitamin deficiencies and mineral deficiencies. And whereas, you know, we're learning about more and more about what our bodies need to function well. And so that's really the idea of what we're talking about. You know, I think it's really important to talk about these issues because there have been so many significant increases in mental illness. And as a culture, we're talking a lot about what things are causing violence in our society, what things are causing people to be on disability for mental illness. And so I really believe in my heart, I just can't imagine eating a junky diet, no matter what the science shows, that that would be good for us. And I know, like I said before, you know, if you think about it, your brain is always on and it takes care of your thoughts and movements and your breathing and heartbeat. And it's working 24/7, even while you're sleeping. And so that means that your brain requires a constant supply of fuel. And that fuel is going to be coming from the foods you eat. And what's in that fuel can make all the difference. So it really is, you know, true that what you eat directly affects the structure and function of your brain and ultimately of your mood. So, for example, diets high in sugar, refined sugars, we know that those are harmful to the brain. They can cause inflammation and increase stress. And multiple studies have found a correlation between a diet high in refined sugars and impaired brain function, and even a worsening of symptoms of mood disorders, such as depression. And so if you're asking, okay, so, you know, how does that occur? What's happening is that the way your foods affect how you feel is that you have serotonin, right, in your brain, which is a neurotransmitter. And that helps you regulate sleep and appetite. It mediates your moods and even inhibits pain. And since about 95% of your serotonin is produced in your gastrointestinal tract, and your gastrointestinal tract is lined with hundreds of millions of nerve cells or neurons, it makes sense that the inner workings of your digestive system don't just help you digest food, but may also be helping you guide emotions. And what's more is that the function of these neurons and the production of neurotransmitters like serotonin are highly influenced by the billions of good bacteria that make up your intestinal microbiome. It's always early, this 8 a.m. show. And so these bacteria, they're going to play an essential role in your health. So they're protecting your lining of your intestines, and they're ensuring that there's a barrier between toxins and bad bacteria. They are limiting inflammation, and they improve how well you absorb nutrients from your food. And they also activate neural pathways that travel directly between your gut and your brain. And so studies have shown that when people take probiotics, these are supplements that contain good bacteria, their anxiety levels, perception of stress, and mental outlook are often improved compared with those who did not take probiotics. Other studies have compared your diet, so traditional diets, like the Mediterranean diet, which I'm sure you guys know all this, but and the traditional Japanese diet, when they compare those to a typical Western diet, they found that the risk of depression is 25% to 35% lower in those who are eating a more Mediterranean or Japanese-type diet. And scientists have accounted for this difference because the traditional diets, which is the Mediterranean and other types of diets like that, tend to be high in vegetables and fruits, unprocessed grains, and fish and seafood, and only contain modest amounts of lean meats and dairy. Now, when we're talking about the Western diet, we're talking about a lot of refined sugars and things like that. And so, obviously, we're going to see differences in mood and well-being and health. One of the things that comes up in regard to those diets is this idea of fermentation. Now, I am not a nutritionist, so this is my very laywoman's terms, I should say, of all of this. But I really think it's incredibly fascinating to think about how much this affects our mental health, and that's why I want to share it with you. And so I'm not going to go super into all of that, but there is this idea that fermentation uses bacteria and yeast to convert sugar in food to carbon dioxide, alcohol, and lactic acid. And that, so because it's used to protect food from spoiling, that it can eventually have, all of these things can have a good impact on your health. So I think, was it kombucha everyone's talking about these days? Like I said, I'm not an expert in that area. But when I stand there and I look at all these foods, sometimes at, say, at Whole Foods, I get a little overwhelmed because it's so much information. And, you know, but if I knew that, hey, these things are going to, I'm having a rough day, I woke up tired, or I need to get back on track, what kinds of things are going to help me, especially help my mood, or just energy level and all those things, I would definitely want to know about them more. But I think we are inundated with so much information that it makes it difficult. So I think one of the things you can do is that you can just start paying attention to how different foods make you feel. You might even use a food journal, things like that, and begin to try to experiment with, you know, when you have dairy, when you have other things, when you've had a day where you've sort of gone up and down with your food choices, how do you feel? And then, you know, I think that that can be helpful. So I would highly recommend that you see a nutritionist if this is something you really want to get into. But given the fact that so many of us are facing such busy, difficult lives, I really it could be really helpful. So let's talk about anxiety and food. So I think this is something that I specialize in working with. Obviously, depression and anxiety are the main streams of treatment for mental illness or mental health challenges, I should say, also. But according to the National Institute of Mental Health, anxiety disorders are the most common mental illness in the U.S. And so that's about 18% or more who struggle with anxiety. And often, anxiety and depression go hand in hand, with about half of those people who are struggling also experiencing depression as well as anxiety. And so we have all these types of therapies and medications, and of course I believe in all of them. I wouldn't be here if I didn't. So like I keep saying, this is an idea to supplement. This is not to replace. I have a lot of patients on medication, and I'm very grateful that they are stabilized on medication. I have a lot of patients who do not want to be on medication. And so I always try to find other resources and ways to, you know, reduce calm, anxiety, things like that. But sometimes it reaches a point where medications truly are life-saving, and I want to keep emphasizing that as well. So in addition to the healthy guidelines, such as eating a balanced diet, there are things like drinking a lot of good water to stay hydrated, limiting alcohol and caffeine, and other types of things like that. For example, complex carbohydrates are metabolized more slowly and therefore help maintain a more even blood sugar level, which can create more calm, so especially if you're feeling stressed. A diet which is rich in whole grains and vegetables and fruits obviously is a healthier option than those with a lot of simple carbohydrates found in processed foods. The other issue that's really important is not skipping meals. I see this a lot, and I understand it myself when we're busy, but the whole hangry concept, it's a real thing. And so it's really important to not to skip meals, to at least have snacks and healthy options, whether it's nuts or fruits, things like that, proteins. Because if you do skip meals, what's happening is you're dropping in your blood sugar levels dropping, and that can cause you to feel more jittery, which can also make any underlying anxiety even worse. So if you're already a person who's struggling with anxiety, I highly recommend that you look at your diet in terms of not only what you're eating, but when you're eating. That's really important. When I was doing this research, I came across another really interesting TED Talk, and I'm not going to play this one today, or I may not play it at all at some point, but I would highly recommend it. It's called Food for Thought: How Your Belly Controls Your Brain. And it was posted in 2015. So once again, that's Food for Thought: How Your Belly Controls Your Brain. I think it's a TEDx talk. And it's talking about the gut-brain axis and how important that is. And so what we want to do is talk a little bit about some relationships with food that affect our gut. And I'm just going to give you some ideas for some foods that can really help calm anxiety when you're feeling it. So one of the ideas that I first came across is that in mice, diets low in magnesium are found to have, my headset just went off. In mice, diets low in magnesium were found to increase anxiety-related behaviors. Foods naturally rich in magnesium may therefore help a person feel calmer. So some examples of these would be leafy greens such as spinach and Swiss chard, other nuts, seeds, and whole grains. Another option are foods which are rich in zinc, such as oysters, cashews, liver, beef, and egg yolks have all been linked with lowering anxiety. Now, I'm sure everyone on the planet, we've all heard this idea of omega-3 fatty acids, but it really has been shown in many studies, and Julia Ruckledge, in that clip I talked about, I know uses this idea in her practice as well. But a study completed on medical students in 2011 was the first to show that omega-3s may help reduce anxiety. And prior to that, it had only been linked to reducing or impacting depression. So I think that's another great one. I mean, like I said before, I think the hard part is you go to Whole Foods or some kind of mother's market and stand there, or even at CVS, frankly, and it's overwhelming the amount of supplements. And because this is not my specialty, I highly recommend that you find someone who is, if you're interested in these things. But these are just sort of simple ones. A recent study in the Journal of Psychiatry Research suggested a link between probiotic foods and a lowering of social anxiety. So eating probiotic-rich foods such as pickles, sauerkraut, and kefir cheese was linked with fewer symptoms. So I think that's really interesting. Asparagus, which we all know how that ends up coming out later, but I think that's another good one that has been widely known to be a healthy vegetable. And in fact, the Chinese government approved the use of an asparagus extract as a natural functional food and beverage due to its anti-anxiety properties. Another one we hear a lot about are foods rich in B vitamins, such as avocados and almonds. And what's really happening is that all these feel-good foods are spurring the release of neurotransmitters, like I talked about before, like serotonin and dopamine, and they're often a safe and easy first step in managing anxiety. Now, a few other things that I'm just going to share with you that came up in terms of foods would be beans, dried small red pinto, black red kidney beans, fruits, apples, prunes, sweet cherries, plums, and black plums, lots of berries, blackberries, strawberries, cranberries, raspberries, blueberries, nuts, which would be walnuts and pecans, especially. That's what I came up here, but there are many others. Vegetables like artichokes, kale, spinach, beets, broccoli, and spices. So spices with both antioxidant and anti-anxiety properties. You want to seek out those like ginger and turmeric. I've never said it, have her to say that one. Turmeric can be helpful. So I'm not going to go on and on a lot today about a lot of other topics, but I do want to say that exploring ways to reduce your anxiety prior to medication, to me, is always the first line of defense. And so those are things like, I mean, you guys probably already know all of these, but things like doing guided imagery and meditation. Exercise is a huge one, I would say, getting your heart rate up for a good, 30 to 45 minutes to an hour while you're breaking a sweat. I don't care if you just walk out the front door. That can be incredibly helpful. I love a lot of apps now for meditations. I will say that, and I tell my patients this, I am not the best at just the straight up quiet meditations. I have what they call the monkey mind. My brain starts thinking about things I need to do and where I need to go. And I wish I could say that I have mastered that, but I have not. So what I found really helpful, not to knock meditation, because if you can do it, that's probably the purest form, go for it. But I really love guided imagery. And I first discovered guided imagery when I was in my doctoral program. I had this incredible, she was like 80-something year old supervisor who had been trained in trauma work. And at the time, I was doing my training with a lot of severe cases of childhood sexual trauma and with adults who had been abused. And it was tough work, but I was just, really seeking new ways to learn how to help them. And so the supervisor began to teach me several things. And one of them was this idea of doing what we call safe place or calm place. And if you are someone who wants to do EMDR, which is something I also do, that's something we teach you in the beginning. But there are lots of exercises where we are basically taking these visualization trips where we're imagining a place where we feel safe and calm and peaceful. And we're doing some deep breathing. Maybe we're also doing progressive muscle relaxation. And once I started practicing on my children, which is pretty funny, I basically made them, do it with me before I could do it with patients so I felt competent. I realized that I had more anxiety than I had ever known because I could really feel the difference when I was doing guided imagery and calming down and breathing. And so there are many apps. I like Insight Timer. There's Headspace. I'm sure Calm. On my resource page on drkimsage.com, I have a ton of apps and links, even links to little articles that say, like, what kind of imagery do you like or what kind of meditations do you like? So feel free to check those out. They really can make a huge difference in learning how to calm. Of course, I also believe that a lot of anxiety is driven from more attachment-based regarding how we grew up, how our parents were, how they are now in our relationships with our lives in terms of how we interact with our partners and our children. Certainly even our jobs can be extremely anxiety provoking. So there are many factors, certainly not just what you eat or just exercising or just doing guided imagery. I think of it as a puzzle that I'm always trying to solve with whoever I'm working with. And what are the pieces of this person's life that are missing? So I hope today, like I said, you'll just take this little tidbit of nutrition. I really do have a passion for learning more about food and mood, and it is something I'm going to pursue and learn how to introduce into my own practice. I'm not there yet, so I would say that, but I'm going to be doing some certification and learning about it. If you want to do that as well, if you're a clinician or just a person who wants to know more, there's a great website called the Center for Nutritional Psychology. Center for Nutritional Psychology. I'll say it again. They have a certification program. There's a website called the Food and Mood Center, and that center with an R-E. It's out of Australia. The earlier clip I played by Julia Ruckledge, and she is a contributing editor to another website called Mad in America, and it's definitely interesting. It's about challenging the notions of traditional psychiatry and psychology, and I'm just sort of stumbling onto that one and learning more about it. I just think it's one more idea to explore. Obviously, I also strongly believe in where we are now, but to me, it's always important to keep pushing and growing and learning. So if you ever see me out walking with headphones, I'm probably, sadly, not listening to fiction because I love fiction, but probably listening to some Audible on tape that I'm going to recommend to you if you come see me, or to my girlfriends or my kids, because there's so many incredible podcasts and books out there. I love Audible for exercising and walking and learning something new. But you can also do walking meditations or affirmations that way. So check those out on any kind of app you can Google. And then, you know, the idea of seeking out cookbooks and trying to maybe just begin to modify your diet with these ideas, I think can be helpful, and see what you can do to change your life. And on that note, you've been listening to Moody with Dr. Sage. I'm your host, Kim Sage, a clinical psychologist. And as I always say, this show is meant to be served for informational purposes only and not meant to replace your psychiatric or psychological treatment, I would say. But if you are in need, please, I highly recommend that you seek support and find ways to enhance your life, whether it's through books or podcasts or therapy or self-help, whatever you can find to change your life. Please, it's incredible what can happen to your relationships when you are open and honest with yourself and just raise your hand and say, you know what? I need help. One way or the other, I need help. So on that note, I hope you have a beautiful day, and I will see you next week. Take care.
Hi, it's Rolling.
I'm sorry, Charlie Murphy. I was having too much fun. Well, sometimes
water, and I think about all the things, and in my head.